from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. The editors of the first anthology of Iranian-American fiction say there is a maturing literary voice emerging from the Iranian-American community. Many Iranian immigrants came to the United States after the Shah was overthrown in 1979, and roughly half of them live in California. We talk with Bay Area editors and authors of Tremors, new fiction by Iranian-American writers about their stories, culture, and community. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of our Forum program. We have a couple of Bay Area fiction writers here with us this hour, actually three, and two who have edited a new anthology of Iranian-American writers called Tremors. 27 authors, actually I believe 28, form this anthology. They come from a potpourri of Iranian backgrounds and roots, and they're included in a new volume of writers who set their fiction in the United States and in Iran and what the editors of the book call Other Land. And let me tell you who is joining us for the hour here in studio. We want to welcome first Anita Amirzavani, who is a novelist. Her most recent novel is called Equal of the Sun. She is a co-editor of Tremors, new fiction by Iranian-American writers. And welcome to the program.
It's good to be here.
Good to have you here. Also good to have Persis Karim. We welcome her back. She's been with us before. She's professor of English and comparative literature and Persian studies at San Jose State University, co-editor of Tremors, this new fiction anthology. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you. And we also want to welcome Amir Soltani, who is an author and co-creator of Zahara's Paradise. It's a graphic novel set in Iran, and an excerpt is in Tremors, new fiction by Iranian-American writers. He is a Bay Area writer. He's in Boston this morning, and glad to have you. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael.
So thank you all for being here. And Anita, let's begin with you. I was thinking, what really marks the fault line of Tremors, to use your title here, and I mean chronologically or historically, and if it was Appomattox for William Faulkner, it's the revolution in 1979.
Absolutely. So before 1979, there wasn't a large population of Iranians in the United States. After 79, all of a sudden, the diaspora Iranians moving to countries all over the world, including the United States, and then laying down roots gradually and very slowly becoming fiction writers, writing poetry, writing memoir. But here with this anthology, we're really seeing a shift from people writing memoir to writing fiction.
And poetry. I mean, the shift is also from poetry.
Absolutely.
And maybe the shift is to graphic fiction writing too, as we see at least in this anthology.
The newest trend, which we're really happy to have represented in the book.
And Persis, what about the title? It actually comes from a novel excerpt that's in the anthology.
Yeah. Well, when we were searching around for a title, we toyed with several ideas. And one of the things that leaped out at us is the idea of Erica Abrahamian's story, Tremors, because in some ways we see this as a kind of seismic shift in the landscape of fiction in the United States. And and also it's the idea that we are moving towards, sorry, I need some water.
Just drink and
moving towards a kind of embracing of fiction as a genre that really stands out in being able to represent the stories that Iranians bring with them or that lay hidden among our parents and grandparents.
Yeah, I was just going to say you have a long tradition of storytelling. I mean, yeah. Back to Persian antiquity. So it's not as if you're suddenly taking fiction as your métier.
Yes. And I think also it really represents the idea that in this collection and across the United States, there are young people now who are entering MFA programs who absolutely feel like fiction is the way to address the stories that Americans and English-speaking readers have never heard before.
We've also got simply more Iranians living in the United States and going through sort of the metamorphosis of identity. I mean, 1979, hundreds of thousands have populated the United States since that, again, fault line year of the revolution of Ayatollah Khomeini. And the fact of the matter is that one of the biggest populations, in fact, is in Los Angeles. But there's a pretty big population here in the Bay Area.
That's right. We don't have exact numbers, but we think it's somewhere between 250,000 and maybe closer to 600,000 in the greater Northern California area. And for many of us who have been sort of plugging along with our dragging our Iranian identities around with us, I think the arts have been a really important galvanizing vehicle for self-representation. And I think that's really important.
But you both, let me go back to you, Anita, both have not only strong ties where Iranian culture is concerned, but here's this hybridized identity, but you both kind of have hybridized identities. You're both from the male line as Iranians, I believe. Is that right? Your mothers are both American?
My mother's from France.
My mother's Lithuanian.
Okay, so there we go. So, you know, I mean, it's not to say that hybridization within hybridization, but there is this kind of codifying often that we, you know, when I interview somebody like Louise Erdrich, she talks about her German ancestry and then she talks about her Native American ancestry. And this is true for so many writers who have this strong sense of identity, whether it's on the paternal side or the maternal side. But you both have immersed yourself in Iranian identity and Iranian literature. And I guess, you know, the major themes are the themes of immigrant people and of different generations and assimilation. But the Iranian motifs or central themes are different to a great degree because particularly after the taking over the embassy, there was tremendous enmity against Iranians. Most Iranians I knew were saying suddenly they were Persians, for example. Right?
Yeah.
And things began to change in terms of your own way that you saw yourself, I imagine, because there was so much negative about Iran. And there still is.
Right. My own experience, I think, speaks to that. I was born in Iran, but mostly raised in the United States. And in the 1970s, when I was a teenager, I was going back to Iran quite a bit. My parents were divorced at that time. And so I was living in the U.S. with my mother, but spending a lot of time in Iran with my father's side of the family and the dozens of relatives I had. And it's often hard for people to remember this now, but that was a time when the U.S. and Iran had friendly relations and when there were literally tens of thousands of Americans working in Iran and tens of thousands of Iranians studying in the United States. So that was a point where the two countries knew each other very well, or at least relatively well, unlike now. Now imagine, I'm 16 years old. I've decided to spend a year in Iran to be with my father's side of the family. I'm taking a break between high school and college. That turns out to be the year of the revolution.
You were there in 78, I guess.
I was there in 78, yeah. Right. My family decided to leave in December of that year. And so eventually I made my way to college the following year. And all of a sudden, everything changed. So I went from a personal situation of the U.S. and Iran being close and friendly and everybody liking Iran in the U.S. to all of a sudden the situation of hatred and this idea, you know, this feeling after the hostage crisis that Iranians needed to call themselves Persians to avoid being targets of hatred and possibly even violence.
Anita Amirizvani again is with us in studio along with Persis Karim. They are co-editors of a new collection of fiction by Iranian-American writers. And I want to bring Amir Soltani into this, author and co-creator of Zahara's Paradise. And boy, that brings us right up to the present. That is your work, which was done in conjunction, I believe, in collaboration with an Arab American artist, whom we should name, if you would.
Khalil.
And Zahara's Paradise is based on the real Green Revolution events, and in fact brings us right up to the next election, where there's a good deal of hope and promise that maybe Ahmadinejad will no longer be the president of Iran, although the mullahs are clearly ruling that country. But there's actually even a presidential bid for Zahara. Let's talk about who Zahara is.
You know, when we when the 2009 revolts were taking place, we saw on YouTube the image of an Iranian mother, the video of her as she was about to bury her son. Her son was participating in the protests, and he had disappeared. And she was looking for him for about 20, 24 days. And she was looking in the hospitals and in the morgue and in the streets, you know, everywhere. And finally, she had found him dead. And when you looked at this mother in Zahra's Paradise, which is the name of the main cemetery in Iran, on her face, you really could sort of see the experience of, you know, the years, just reflecting the grief and the sorrow and the rage and almost the denial. I mean, every inch and iota of her being was refusing to bury her son, refusing that reality. And that's a reality that I think a lot of Iranians have been hurt by, the trauma, in a sense. But I, you know, what we were hoping to reflect in Zahra's Paradise was the power of life that's taking place in Iran. I mean, the protests in 2009 didn't come out of nowhere. And in a sense, even though the American hostage crisis has ended, in many ways Iranians remain hostages of a kind of brutal fundamentalism that's made the crane the reflection or the symbol of our country and our religion. And, you know, millions really were taking to the streets and they were turning their cell phones into instruments for documenting the truth and reality as they saw it. And so Zahra's Paradise and really the anthology is a way to hold up another mirror and show the face of another Iran. And so when my dear Persis and Anita contacted us to include Zahra's Paradise in the anthology, it was a little bit, it was a tremendous discovery for me because the anthology, in a sense, was a kaleidoscope into all these other authors and the ways in which they were seeing and reflecting on Iran, the ways in which they're sort of mining memory and history to project and portray an Iran that's much closer, the lived Iran, if you will. And so, you know, to discover that you belong to a larger community, that you're not alone, really was a gift. So when I would go to the readings that Persis had organized, and I'd hear all these other writers and hear their voice crackle, and just the twinkle and the subtlety and the rebellion, it was just beautiful. And so for us, you know, for me, the anthology, what Persis and Anita have done is to sort of remind me that, you know, in a way, Iran is our roots and America is our wings. And we're sort of moving beyond the hostage crisis and the terrorist nonsense and all of this stuff and really bringing our two beautiful cultures together in ways that we can celebrate and really enjoying each other's company while we're doing it.
Well, we should say that we have posted images of your work and links to the Zahra for President website on our website, kqed.org. Why did you decide to do this story as a graphic novel as opposed to just writing the story?
Well, you know, it was a bit of a, like everything else with Iranians, serendipity is a factor. A friend of mine had published a graphic novel with First Second, which is the Macmillan graphic novels division. And I'd met Khalil, who's this beautiful and brilliant artist. And it just, you know, and I think visually, I'm working in documentary film, and it just flowed. It just made sense. And really, I mean, the protests of 2009, the language was also images. I mean, thousands of photos were pouring out of Iran, blogs and all of these. And in a sense, Zahra's Paradise was a way for us to connect the images and the blogs into a single story that would come close, perhaps, to reflecting reflecting the reality. And then the other thing with the graphic novel is that it's the fastest, easiest, and cheapest way to communicate, especially when you connect the graphic novel to the Internet, which is the vision that our editor, Mark Siegel, had. And then suddenly you realize that, you know, all these barriers of time and space and distance, language even, with Google Translate, can collapse. And so those of us Iranians who've been in these little corners huddled and doing our own thing away from each other, suddenly technology from the cell phone to the, you know, to the Internet, which is the modern stuff, to the graphic novel, which in a way is like the revolutionary pamphlet, we can put these things together in ways that kind of shock and surprise us and allow us to connect with the world and say, no, there is another Iran. There is an Iran that's, you know, Zahra's Iran, which is why we're having her run for president.
This is a virtual campaign, in fact, and as I said, you can go to our website and find out more about it. And Amir Soltani is the author and co-creator of Zahra's Paradise. And let me do this at this point. I want to open the phone lines and invite those of you who are listening to join this discussion, particularly like to hear from Iranian Americans and talk about really hybridized identity in general. I happen to be one of those who has studied a lot of writers from what we call ethnic identity or hybridized identity. One thinks of, for example, a lot of them women writers. I mentioned Louise Erdrich. One thinks of Leslie Marmon Silko as another Native American writer, or writers like Maxine Hong Kingston and Amy Tan as Chinese American writers, or Sandra Cisneros and Elena Ferramontes, Latina or Mexican American writers. What does it mean to have a hybridized identity? And what does it mean in terms of the major themes from your experience? I'm addressing Iranian Americans, obviously, but also any of you who have this hybridized identity and feel the process of assimilation and the tug between that, the conflict between that and your identity with your roots and your folklore and all of the stories that are oral or part of your tradition culturally. Our toll-free number is available now, and you can feel free to join us. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your involvement in the program, and please feel free to call us. Again, it's 866-733-6786. Or if you have questions or comments for our guests here, because the editors of this first anthology of Iranian-American fiction say that there's a maturing literary voice that's emerging from the Iranian-American community, many Iranian immigrants having come here after the Shah and the Peacock Throne was overthrown in 1979. Roughly half of them, we should add, live here in California. The new book is called Tremors, New Fiction by Iranian-American Writers, about their stories, their culture, their community. I should mention there are Baha'i Iranian writers and Jewish Iranian writers and Kurdish Iranian writers from so many different traditions. And you may want to come and join us. Again, toll-free 866-733-6786 or by email forum@kqed.org or on our website, kqed.org/forum, and simply click on the segment. And you can also go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Persis, you're also writing in the story of yours that's included in this anthology about a fairly tough political question. I mean, in the wake of after 9/11, you're writing about the detainment of United States citizens who happen to be of Iranian descent. How much research did you do on this, and how much was this commonplace?
Well, I did do some research. It was a well-known and documented news story that after 9/11, there were a series of edicts or decrees by the Justice Department to interrogate and bring in various immigrant communities to talk a little bit about what kind of information they knew. And I read about this story, and it really troubled me because, in a way, it represents the way that I think a lot of Iranians have felt very caught between the tragedies of their own history inside of Iran, and then felt victimized again by being immigrants who've been vilified in the United States. And I think that's especially true after 9/11.
Well, forgive me, your protagonist, in fact, has a son killed in Iran, and then Mohsen,
yeah.
And then he comes to be under this interrogation, the FBI asking him for names, essentially, is what they're doing.
Yeah. And this is something that I think you can probably ask a group of 100 Iranians if they knew somebody who was killed or executed or jailed during the period right after the 79 revolution. I have two cousins who were served jail time inside the notorious Evin prison, both women. But many of my friends have had close family members or friends who were executed by the regime in Iran. And so I think what I was trying to depict in that story is the sort of painful experience of coming to grips with the traumatic events of what happened inside of Iran after the revolution, and also the painful realities of being an immigrant in this country where that story isn't even known.
Sorry you're having so much trouble with your voice, by the way. Let me actually go to you on this, Anita. The stories, some of them are political, but there's really a range here, too. You have some stories which are just really trying to craft fiction and tell about human events, and it's important, I think, isn't it, from your perspective or your vision to have those two join?
One thing I was really happy to find when we put out a call for submissions for the work here, in other words, we didn't know exactly what we were going to get. We were thrilled to find a range of voices. So as you mentioned, not just voices from the excuse me, Jewish or Baha'i
I think
perspectives.
This is infectious for a moment.
Sorry.
For example, but voices that were describing, for instance, experiences before the revolution in Iran and experiences after the revolution, and those in some cases those really are political experiences. So encounters with the Shah's secret police on the one hand, then encounters with the Islamic Republic's secret police on the other hand. We happen to have two parallels.
There wasn't that much difference when Savak was disbanded. It was simply reconstituted, I think, under Khomeini.
Right. So people are writing into these experiences of difficulty in Iran, but they're also writing into experiences of joy and of reinterpreting the Iranian experience. One story I want to cite is Ari Seletz's story, which focuses on the jinn, the genie. And he is basically taking that really old motif and reinterpreting it in a modern way. And I think what you'll find is a lot of the writers in the anthology are doing that. They're trying to come to grips with this huge, long Iranian history that you cited, Michael, and playing with it and reinventing it and being creative with it and addressing the struggles of it. One thing I do want to mention related to 2009 and the protests in Iran is that that was a point where I think the world started to have some sympathy for the Iranian people in recent years and what they're going through. But, you know, the struggle for democracy has been ongoing in Iran since about 1906, the constitutional revolution and the overthrow of the monarchy that occurred in that year, and that was gradually taken away from the people and the people grabbed back and was taken away again. There has been so much struggle in Iran for the past 100 years for democracy. And I think these writers in this book are really writing into some of that pain and some of that struggle with a lot of depth and a lot of feeling.
Well, your story, A New Assignment, is really about kind of Iran from another era. It's still the Pahlavi or the Peacock Throne, I believe, isn't it? Because we're talking about the Shah and his princess daughter, Peri, who is essentially talking with a eunuch who is describing at her request what he had to go through to become a eunuch. So a lot of this is not only taking, you mentioned the jinn, for example, taking folkloric material, but going back and looking at your history and using the fiction as the vehicle to bring that history to the fore.
That's right. In my novel, my key concern there, because it is set in the 16th century, is to look at the way women have been represented in the Middle East. And unfortunately, there is an enormous amount of stereotyping that's been going on with the idea that women basically, you know, think of the French Orientalist painters, think of those great canvases of the women lounging around naked in harems with all the fruit hanging out and the fountains gushing. And the whole sexualization of women in the Middle East has been so prominent in our sort of imaginative narrative. And yet, what I find fascinating is that recent scholarship has been going back and digging into actual court records and looking at the role that women actually played. And one of these women, whose name was Pari, is the subject of my novel. I find it fascinating that she was, in fact, a major power player at the Iranian court during the time of Queen Elizabeth I, that she fought for power with the best of the guys, that she was considered intelligent, equally educated, she was very wealthy, and she was very powerful. Now, this is a narrative about Middle Eastern women we just don't hear.
Well, let's hear from you, our listeners. We want to bring you into this conversation. I'd ask about hybridized identity, but really interested in the images and themes. There's a reality show now about Iranian Americans in Beverly Hills, and I'm sure we might want to talk about that. It's given a whole new view that a lot of Iranian Americans are probably upset about.
It's not that new.
Well, but you may want to join the program just to talk about images you have of Iranian Americans or the themes that really are pervasive and becoming more prominent in the culture with a very dynamic literary world of writers here, right here in the Bay Area. In fact, give a shout out to my friend Suzanne Pari, who is probably listening, who is a literary light in her own. You can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQED Forum, or go to our Facebook page, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The editors of the first anthology of Iranian-American fiction are here. They say there's a maturing literary voice emerging from the Iranian-American community, and many Iranian immigrants came to the United States after the Shah was overthrown back in 1979. and roughly half are presently living in California. We're talking to the editors of Tremors, new fiction by Iranian-American writers, about their stories, their culture, their community. And Amir Soltani is also with us, co-creator of Zahara's Paradise, which is a graphic novel set in Iran during the Green Revolution of 2009. You are certainly welcome to join this program, and we welcome your calls. Toll free, 866-733-6786, or your emails, forum@kqed.org. Or you can go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And any questions or comments, you can register there. Anita and Persis, by the way, will be speaking at a fundraiser for the Dear Iran Project, which will be in San Rafael on May 18th. And you can find details about that at bridgeofhearts.org. And Persis Karim is professor of English and comparative literature and Persian studies at San Jose State. And Anita Amarasvani is a novelist. Her most recent novel, by the way, is Equal of the Sun, and she and Persis are co-editors of Tremors. Amir Soltani, let me, before I go to calls, how did you get involved in this project?
A call from Persis. She called and said, Amir, we want Zahra's Paradise in our anthology, and it surprised me a little bit because, you know, graphic novels tend to be considered the sort of junior partners in the universe of fiction, and that was just a sort of magical moment.
I'm looking at an invitation to the Dear Iran Project, and in the photograph, this event that's dedicated to the people of Iran, which will be at the Unitarian Church in San Rafael that I mentioned, May 18th, 7 and 9:30, looking at a picture, all these women holding up victory signs and looking very happy, pretty much have headgear on, so to speak, which I suppose in Iran. Now, I saw a movie which I suspect both of you saw called Separation, which I thought was spectacularly good movie, one of the best foreign films I've seen. And the autocracy, the rule of the mullahs, where women are concerned, I mean, still, it has to be mentioned here, is still very much oppressive. And I'm not even talking about clothing. I mean, clothing is just a small symbol of it, obviously. But from the perspective of wanting to tell those women's stories, and Zahara is just one of those women, you know, whose son was disappeared. It feels like you've taken on this as a kind of moral or sacred duty almost.
Well, I think one of the things that we both feel, and I think if I'm not speaking out of line for Amir, is the idea that to embrace Iran and Iranian culture is not to be an apologist for this regime. In fact, it's to reject the horrible policies that are perpetuated against Iran and its people, and to sort of suggest that Iranians are incredibly resilient and, you know, willing to take tremendous risks to voice their humanity across, you know, the globe. And I think one of the things that we wanted to do was to challenge the notion that, you know, if you portray Iran and Iranians with any kind of positive light, you are an apologist for this regime. And in fact, neither one of us would want to be in Iran right now because it's a really difficult place for Iranian Americans, especially because the government there has really targeted Iranian Americans who are public figures. And I think women in particular have been incredibly resilient, and I think it's fair to say that the 2009 uprisings after the election were really a result of women organizing for years and years, the 1 million signatures campaign and the work of Shirin Ebadi have been really important to the kinds of public protests that have taken place in Iran, especially in the last 5 years. And we want to celebrate the contributions of women and women writers. And, of course, in this collection, the preponderance of the writers are indeed women. And the last collection I did, Let Me Tell You Where I've Been, was all women. And I think, in a way, it's a really important idea that women who've come here or been born here of Iranian heritage have really taken up the pen and taken up the pen in ways that I think challenge the notion that women are silent and passive and unable to express themselves.
Well, let me actually bring one of the few males in the anthology back into the discussion here. Amir Soltani, you're really trying to wage a campaign. I mean, there have been YouTubes that have try to bring Iranians and Americans together, try to bring Iranians and Israelis together to show that there are people on both sides of goodwill who want peace and who want something that will bring the sides that have been at war, almost silent or otherwise, together. Is Zahara's candidacy really potentially something that is viable, or is it just a symbolic thing? And were she to get some kind of overwhelming support, one would presume that there would be no likelihood of her taking office.
Is obviously a fictional character and a virtual character. But, you know, the Islamic Republic's been allergic to fiction, even though so much of it is also fiction. The whole idea of, rule of the supreme jurisprudent is this fiction that Ayatollah Khamenei somehow represents God. And so we've had a combat of fictions, if you will.
Well, one thinks of Salman Rushdie, unfortunately.
Oh, it's very interesting, that point. But, you know, in a certain sense, nothing that Salman Rushdie has done to the name of the Prophet begins to compare with what the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khamenei, and so on are doing in the name of the Prophet. And so by having Zahra run as a candidate for president, what was very fortunate is that, you know, again, it's Iranian women behind the helm. My friend Firuzeh, who runs United for Iran, and a whole number of other women are actually behind the campaign. And their vision, their idea is that, first of all, the notion that women can't run for president is ridiculous, and we're challenging that. But then Zahra is also running on a very solid human rights platform, which is based on, you know, no to executions. We want the release of all political prisoners. And so the principles that she stands for are actually very serious ones and ones that resonate very deeply with Iranians. So, you know, where the campaign will go, what its impact will be, depends on what, you know, what people decide to do. But she's running as a protest candidate.
I think it's going to be fascinating to see what kind of support she actually gets and what kind of support will be revealed, if any, when this election next month takes place in Iran. But let me go to our callers, and let's begin, Odette, with you. Good morning.
Good morning. What a wonderful program. I called because as an Assyrian Iranian, we were students here during the hostage crisis, and we were faced with a lot of adversity from our schoolmates, from our neighbors. And one day we came home and we found our whole house TP'd, and there was pumpkin squash all over the garage driveway. And so my mother said, you know, I'm going to cook for these neighbors, and I'm going to invite all of them over. And then you four children are in charge of educating them. Each one of you take a few of them and explain to them who we are, what we are, and tell them that we also are hostage to the situation. And going back to the women's resiliency.
Well, wait a minute. How's your mother? Your mother's cooking win the day?
My mother cooked food for the whole neighborhood, invited everyone over, and whoever came gave them doggy bags, and they took home with them too, and they left with a big smile on their face and educated that not everyone is a hostage taker. At that time, it wasn't called terrorists. It was called hostage takers. And it left us in peace. People were aware now that not everyone takes hostages, and not everyone that comes from Iran is adverse to the culture here. We are, after all, here because we are not able to live there.
That's a great story. You should put it into another anthology. It really is. It's a very uplifting story, and I'm glad you called. Thank you, Odette. Let me get another caller on here, and it's Nima from Santa Clara. Good morning.
Hi, Michael. How are you doing?
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to first thank you for having all the Iranian authors today in this program. Just so happy to hear this whole conversation happening. Just wanted to say, like, I'm Iranian, been lived and raised in Iran till I was 18. Then I came to Canada, lived there for a few years, and then ended up in Bay Area for my master's, and now I'm staying here. So I have a American girlfriend who I'm living with right now. And so when we're going through this process of she knowing about my culture, about my past, and every day, almost every day, she getting amazed at the fact at what she didn't know about this whole picture that I'm drawing for her, and she is amazed at how little maybe Americans in the world know about this realistic picture of what's really going on. And now, in the light of this so much political negativity that is going on, that is really overpowering everything real and everything personal and everything human that is going on, I really feel like this maturing literary voice that you're talking about is really so gives so much hope to me, because it's the world that really needs to hear the real picture about a real Iranian is, and the whole life and the whole situation that they're going through.
Well, thank you for those remarks, Nima. Good to hear from you. Either of you want to comment on this, Anita?
I do. Actually, I was chuckling to myself here that I think we should start a Be Nice to an Iranian campaign, just because the past 30 years have been full of adversity for Iranians. The revolution, the hostage crisis in terms of the effect on Iranian Americans, the Iran-Iraq war, and then the subsequent government. I mean, these have been really difficult things for Iranians to deal with both here and abroad and in Iran. Not to mention the fact of just having to assimilate into a whole new country. Just imagine if you had to leave your country, you thought you might be coming back, and then you ended up living somewhere else for the rest of your life. I mean, this is the situation with many members of my family and many Iranians around the country. They had to pick up and leave, and they've never seen their country again. Be nice to
Iran. I think what we're emphasizing is the importance of people seeing the humanity and individuality of Iranians, but I'm wondering what you think about. I alluded to it before. I realize that it may create some levity because of the shallowness of it, but the portrayal of these kind of wealthy Beverly Hills Iranians in this reality show, which has extraordinary number of viewers.
Well, I've only seen one episode of it, and to be honest with you, I was pretty turned off by it because it represents a particular class, in a very elite and wealthy class of Iranians that, don't reside for the most part in Northern California, and they're in some ways the representatives of this very obscene period in Iran's history, where there was a great deal of corruption and people benefited from the relationship to the Shah. And I mean, I think in some ways it's not surprising, because if you look at reality TV, it's more of that. But I think one of the important things is that in some ways it suggests that there is a presence for Iranians on reality TV. I personally don't care for that particular image of Iranians.
But that's a kind of breakthrough, as you're intimating.
Yeah, and it's, it's reality TV. I think one of the things I want to kind of bring back into the conversation is the idea that when Iranians, like other ethnic communities, and you know this, Michael, from your work of teaching and studying ethnic literature, when communities have the capacity to tell their own stories and represent themselves, it's really a critical moment for them to be able to control or have a narrative that is their own instead of being narrated by others. And I think that's a really important aspect of all this literature, Anita's book and some of the other authors who have novels or collections of poetry, is that it presents to American readers and the American public the idea that, there are many stories, and that those stories fall outside the purview of this kind of drumbeat of negative images that pictures these mullahs who are zealous and mean-spirited and who just want to come to loggerheads with the United States. And
Let me also say here, because I think it's important to say that there was leadership in this just because of the historicity of it among Black and Jewish American writers. I mean, in terms of providing the beacons for these other ethnic writing that other writers that have come into the well, what we think of as the canon, I guess, or hope as the canon. Here's Susu, who writes on our website, "Great that you are bringing visibility to Iranian-American writers. We have a thriving theater community that brings this community's experience and perspective to life on stage. See Golden Thread Productions' upcoming world premiere of 444, 444 Days by Toraj Yeghazarian." And Ingrid says, "I recently read the book Let Me Tell You Where I've Been, edited by Persis Karim. It's a collection of short stories and poems. Very interesting, informative, emotional, and certainly well-written. I was disappointed that I come to the end of the book. Now I look forward to reading Tremors. My thanks to your three guests who have brought additional stories and authors to the public in Tremors." And I think, did you want to add something here, Amir?
Well, this discussion of adversity and women, when you look at Iranian women in America, whether it's in philanthropy, and there are prominent Iranian women philanthropists in the Bay Area, or medicine, or the arts, literature, Taraneh Hamami's work, I mean, there is such brilliance and such creativity. I mean, Anousheh Ansari, this other Iranian woman, was the first woman into space. So I think, you know, focusing too much on the mullahs and adversity is great, but also what's come out of this adversity is phenomenal. I mean, I remember growing up in Iran, my grandmother would tell me stories about how she wasn't around, you know, her father, who's very wealthy, had sort of forbidden her to learn how to read and write. And every day when her younger brother would come back from school, she'd sort of yank him away and make him teach her everything he'd learned in school. And that's how she learned how to read and write, and then in turn sent my mother out to you know, to study whatever she wanted. So, I mean, the brilliant, you know, I think the adversity, oppression, all of this stuff is all great and good, but what's also phenomenal is the sense of possibility that's emerging out of Iranians outside and inside Iran. And I think that's cause for celebration. I mean, Iran looks very oppressive, and is very, the government is certainly very oppressive. But when you look at the fact that separation is coming out of that oppression, when you look at what the filmmakers are doing, when you think about what the bloggers and journalists are doing, it's brilliant. And so, you know, just one other sort of little point to add is that, you know, in terms of my family's experience, and I think a lot of families, the acts of grace and friendship that Americans have extended to us as immigrants, you know, my mom, and, you know, whether it's American Jews, African Americans, Mexican Americans, I mean, all, really, I mean, there is still something, there is a bond here. There's a friendship that's made America this home for millions of Iranians. And you know, it's been hard, the hostage crisis and all of these things, but the friendships are also very deep and worthy of celebration.
Well, let me, in fact, since I mentioned the separation, mention an American film that was made from a novel by Andrew DeBose III, called The House of Sand and Fog, which I thought was a sympathetic portrayal. It was a mixed portrayal, but nevertheless a sympathetic portrayal of an Iranian colonel, former colonel, who comes to the United States as an immigrant and takes over a house that was the property of somebody else. And you wind up feeling, let's say, sympathetic, which I think is what we're talking about here. Let me bring more of your calls on. Michelle, you're on. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to bring a little bit of women in Islam from a historical perspective. When I was in grad school a long time ago, I read a book called The Two Queens of Baghdad, and it was set in the, I think it was the Abbasid Empire in Baghdad. And I'm afraid I'm not at home, so I can't look it up. But it was one of the few books I actually kept from grad school and that I actually read from cover to cover. And it was nonfiction, which is unusual for me. But it was really interesting because it showed how powerful women were in early Islamic empire. So I wondered if your guest could comment on that. And second of all, excuse me, also that it these days, sometimes there's this perception of some people that Islam is anti-women. And I think, first of all, it's kind of silly. Second of all, that it seems to me that some of those apparent restrictions on women in various predominantly Islamic countries tend to come from the culture rather than from Islam. And I wondered if your guests could comment on that as well.
Well, we'll have our guests comment. In fact, I know Anita wants to comment on your first point, but I just want to read something from our website that Chris posted. It says, it is true that Iranian women are not granted equal rights, but let us be cultural relativists. How it is it in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, etc. When judged against those peers, especially Saudi Arabia, Iran does quite well with women's rights, but they are an enemy of our state, and so the regime will be demonized no matter what. There's a strong point of view. Anita, you want to respond?
I think these are good points. I haven't read the book that the caller mentions, but I think her points are well taken. There, as I mentioned, there is a lot of reinterpreting going on now about women in the Middle East. And I think some of the problems in terms of describing what their lives have actually been like and the power they've actually have had access to is the fact of gender segregation that's gone on for a long time. So, for instance, in the case of the character I write about, she is represented by male historians. Now, those male historians would never have had direct access to a woman of her rank. So you can see right there the problem of representation that occurs. Now, we are, of course, not talking about a situation in these periods of equal rights. But I think what's really important here is that behind the scenes power is very important and very powerful. And that's something that's often forgotten in current feminist discourse, which wants women's power to be really forefronted.
I want to mention something else here, since you talked about it being ridiculous to look at Islam as being anti-women. Karen Armstrong, a British theological scholar who is one of our leading theological scholars, wrote a book on fundamentalism, and she said all religions, in terms of the fundamentalism of the religion, and we're talking about fundamentalist Islam, fundamentalist Christianity, fundamentalist or Orthodox Judaism, and for that matter, Orthodox Hinduism, really have built within them a kind of oppression and inequality and even misogyny where women are concerned. I mean, that just, I think, prima facie is out there.
I think that's an excellent point. What Karen Armstrong is saying is that we're all moving out of a situation of patriarchy, and that moving out of it is slower or faster depending on where you are. But it doesn't mean that it's inherent or it has to continue forever in any given religion. I do want to point out, though, that I think that often the women's issue is emphasized in Iran at the expense of men. People always talk about how women have to cover up, and they do, but there is a code of dress for men as well. And for whatever reason, that often gets forgotten. But power is expressed, political power is often expressed on people's bodies, and particularly on women's bodies. And that's one thing we've definitely seen in Iran.
Yeah, I'd have a problem growing a beard. it gets stubbly. You're listening to Forum. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we will continue with more of your phone calls. Abrahim joins us next. Good morning.
Morning, guys. I have to first of all mention that my English is not perfect as your guest or some other people call. And the reason why I just came out of Iran like 4 years ago exactly. I have a 3-year-old boy. He just born in Bay Area, United States. My wife is American. But my point is, I see this conversation based by my experience. I'm a 4-year-old, and I just came here by 35 years old, and I started at the beginning. And I see those people talking about the poem or some other thing some of your guests mentioned about the Shirin Ebadi, and some other thing they saying about the worthy people back to revolution as the Shah came here and make a reality show. Okay, what's the point? The point is we have to do something for our next generation. You guys have a boy or girl, they're born here. What they asking you, what happened to your motherland? What they want to answer them? If they sanction kings as a government in the United States, is good. Why you not us sanctioning our motherland to not going there? Because so many women, they're talking about your guests going back home to make a surgery and come back to the United States because they're cheaper there. And there's so many things we can stop it to rid of this government.
All right, Abrahim, I thank you for the call. I'm not sure I got the essence of that call, but did either of you, what he was saying? I mean, about the motherland and... surgery and
The thing that stood out for me is I actually do think that what we're doing in literature is I have a 10-year-old son and I want him to know something about his heritage. You know, I didn't grow up speaking Persian. When I was a kid, I looked for literature that spoke to my experience of being a hyphenated American.
Literature does politicize. I think we're getting to sort of the what yeah. I think the essence of his criticism was.
But I think you know, in a sense, what we're doing is putting the experience of Iranian Americans on the map of literature in this country and hopefully in a global context to suggest that there isn't one story or one Iran. Or one Iranian American experience, but there are many, and those many stories are really valuable.
In fact, again, this anthology, Tremors, is divided into three parts. The first part, settings here in the United States, the second in Iran, and the third, what's called Other Land, cultural hybridity and Iranian backgrounds, which essentially are dramas and stories, fiction taking place in other lands. Let me go to another caller. Ramona, good morning.
Sure, Michael. I just wanted to ask a quick question about Persian culture. The people I've met from Iran are usually very quick to say that they are, make the distinction that they are Persian, not Arab, that they speak Farsi, not Arabic. And I don't know much about the Middle East and the history. And so my question is, do Iranian Americans feel doubly as double outsiders? Is there a feeling, sense of feeling outside, an outsider in that region even? Do Persians feel outsiders in the Middle East, and then you come to America and feel not completely integrated into America either? So that's my question.
Yeah, and Amir, can I go to you on this? Because you have a name that probably often is assumed to be Arabic, and do you find yourself having to explain to people, I'm Persian, I'm Iranian, I'm not Arabic?
Not really. I mean, I've never had this Iranian-Arab sort of hostility. I've always felt it's a little bit imposed and a little bit false. I mean, Iran is a country that's influenced by many, many cultures. I mean, crossroads of so much, from the Greeks and Arabs and Chinese and Mongols and the Brits and the Russians. I mean, some of those have been power relationships, but, you know, Zahra's Paradise was an Iranian-Arab venture. And, in fact, so much of the protest that took place in Iran in 2009, you know, in a sense, the Iranian Spring or the Persian Spring instantly moved to the Arab world. So, I think, for my generation, which is a little bit the Internet generation, these sort of distinctions of tribe and territory are a little bit tiring. I mean, what is an Arab? What is an Iranian? I mean, what's interesting is the conversations that we have and the ways in which we grow together. And, I think in a way the nation state is so 18th century.
I'm going to have to enter in here because it's a good note to end on, actually. I want to thank all of our guests, Amir, Persis, and Anita, and thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. Forbes produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And you can continue this discussion on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.